taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling, don't forget, you still need to send in that pledge of support to finalize your promise to KPFT. But be warned, that fantastic feeling will soon follow. Thanks for supporting KPFT Houston.
Just kidding. I'm not going to make you listen to that again. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. Up next.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greeting and welcome. Greetings and welcome. Greetings and welcome.
Greetings.
Technology Bytes. Greetings.
Greetings. Welcome.
Welcome.
It's strange. Gmail will not let me open the Google Hangouts message. Strange.
It's trying to protect you from Peter Hughes.
Are you doing it from Chrome?
I am. I'm using the approved technology.
Are you thinking the correct thoughts? Are you thinking only approved thoughts when you open this application?
I would let them tell me.
Oh, they'll tell you.
They'll tell me if I'm thinking right or not.
You might have to download an app for that.
That's been pre-downloaded. They went ahead and pushed that out. All right, welcome to Technology Bytes. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's...
Groovehouse.
Groovehouse.
All right, Lee's back. Hooray.
I'm back.
Yay.
Thanks, everybody.
We
missed you. An arm, almost.
Minus an arm.
I've got it. It's just all taped up and stuff.
His arm thinks it's special.
I'm a little teapot. Short. It's kind of what it... Sort of on the side. They're like...
If you only look from the shoulders up, it's kind of got a lederhosen effect. That's...
Oh, yeah, because it's got...
Yeah.
It's got straps on both sides.
Hey-o.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is. It'll make it easy to find.
Ich trage heute Lederhosen.
Wasser.
Ich trage heute. That's what we used to do that in German class. That's the today I'm wearing. Ich trage heute Hosen. It's today I'm wearing pants. Well, that's a lie.
We appreciate... yeah.
No pants
I
Wednesday.
I thought we had that talk. I guess we got to have the talk again.
Oh.
Lord of mercy. All right, well, join us online at geekradio.com.
That's with or without pants.
Please wear pants when visiting the
website. You know
website.
What? If you don't want to wear pants when you visit the website, that's your business. What now you do in your own home.
You've redefined the word scraping. All right, at the Google Hangout. And I'm the only one there. That doesn't sound
Peter Hughes
right.
Is MIA.
Is he MIA? Maybe he's on the way here from San Antonio.
Afflicted's tapping away over there.
All right. Well, we're doing the best we can here. So anyway, visit us online at geekradio.com. That's the website, pants or no pants, however you feel you need to get there. You can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com. And the channel is Tech Bytes. If you do not know how to use your own IRC software, we provided you the most secure way to access it via the Javas. Is your phone ringing?
No, someone's calling someone on Google Hangouts.
Afflicted, getting a phone call.
Yeah, I sent Peter an invite, and then I guess he ignored it and called me. So now you're on a different one than Peter's on.
Oh, great. I'll disconnect, maybe.
I'm already in one, but evidently maybe I can take Peter to that one.
Man, if only there was a show we could call in for help with all this technology.
I'll take you there.
All right. So anyway, irc.cuckoo.com, the channel within the show within a show. We are happy to host. We are going through our normal let's get everything together and pretend like we know what we're doing phase.
I evidently hung up on him.
Good for you. All right. So anyway.
This feels like about every conference call I've been on for the past week. Like everyone, there's a big trend to go, you know, do video calls recently in the workplace where you don't have to buy dedicated video gear. You can use, you know, services like Google and you can use whatever.
Right.
And it sounds like a great idea, but every time anyone wants to do that, it seems like we spend the first half of the meeting just trying to get everyone on the same call.
Yep,
everyone on the same thing. And then suddenly we're just like, just, you know what, let's just pass out the conference number. Just call us.
Yep.
Put them on speaker.
I'm familiar with that dance.
Is it safe to update all the Javas now?
You should always update.
Update the Javas.
Wasn't there
unless, use the Javas
unless they break your technology because
right.
we have
no.
Which
we
many
have
of them do.
We have, you know, certain Java based applications that really don't play well with certain versions.
There was a
of
time
Java.
There where the Javas were a little scared to
it's
update,
a good,
right?
It's a good time to delete the Javas.
Delete the Javas?
Yeah,
okay.
Just get rid of them.
You don't even need Javas.
You need Java.
Yeah,
you need Java in the morning.
Who needs Java?
I've got to have it for Eclipse.
Got to have it for Illuminate. Got to have it for Oracle. Got to have it for...
Because I don't actually have Java installed.
Got to have it for getting up in the morning.
Back when I had a
most
real
of my
job,
Macs
I
now.
I have it for a ton of stuff. Every system, with every embedded system, every storage system, everything had a console, and they all required distinct, isolated versions of JDK.
That's why I installed a VM of Windows and run Java on it.
Hey, there you go.
Now, what version of Flash do you guys like? That's safe, right?
I don't like Flash.
I'm joking around.
I don't like it.
I wish there were more Flash websites. I miss those.
I don't like it.
No, you
inability
don't.
To navigate.
You know,
browser incompatibility.
Flash is just for people too lazy to animate their own GIFs or GIFs or
no,
whatever.
No, it's GIFs. It's
giraffes.
GIF like a... Like
it's GIF.
GIF like a human being.
I'll say GIF.
Just say GIF.
I say GIF.
I say GIF-A.
GIF-A.
JC, GIF-A. well, you know, good times, good times.
I see Peter's picture. Does that mean he's on the thing?
Allegedly, he could be there, but who knows?
Tapping away over there.
You know, it's that whole thing about like being prepared. And I wish we had one of those really cool radio studios where there was two different on-air studios, so you could go in, set yourself up, and then the one studio handed off to the other studio.
No,
but because you guys didn't donate enough money during the fundraiser,
I donated.
We're stuck with this one studio from the 70s.
That
70s studio. Here we go.
Hey, we're in sync. The boy band you never wanted to see.
No, wrong boy band.
There.
So anyway, so yeah. So the
I donated. I opened my pocket.
You did, but
I got stickers.
All right. So this thing happened. Since Pete's not here to direct the conversation, I'm going to direct the conversation.
Where are we going, Jay?
All right. So the CFO of Twitter had his account compromised.
He did. I saw that.
So.
Wow.
So at any rate, so what is it, GigaOhm or whatever,
yeah,
tweeted out that it had happened, and Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle retweeted it, that it had happened, but he modified the tweet to say that, he followed up the tweet to say that he wasn't hacked. He was led to a poison site, which compromised his password. So that just gets I think that's hacking. I don't think it's necessarily very clever or skilled hacking, but if you are...
In the parlance, you can say he was hacked, and that kind of covers it.
Right.
But if you wanted to be real, you know, specific about
it. Well, I get what they're saying. I guess what Dwight's saying is, what Dwight's referring to is the movie style, which is APT, which is Advanced Persistent Threat, which when you've got someone at a keyboard, they're going after someone specifically, they're putting time into it. It's, you know, it's
so they're directing their efforts at a specific target.
Person for a long amount of time using advanced techniques. That's kind of, so that's what a lot of people think, you know, that I'm getting hacked. So that's kind of the classical definition, that's APT. But getting hacked, this hacker still had to go in, they had to set up a site, they had to, you know, set up the drive-by malware, they had to get their exploit code out there, they had to load all this stuff up, and then they had to lure the person in there, and that's still the work of a bad guy.
But did they actually gain access to his account, or was it just one of the, like, cross-site scripting where it posted something?
Yeah, they
something.
Harvested the password and they got in, so that's getting...
That happened, he got hacked.
I mean, if you're tricked into going to a site and supplying your username and password for a service, and then someone goes in and is able to collect that information and use that information to access your account, you've been hacked, I think.
Although now we're perpetuating the bad use of the term.
Right, hack versus cracked. I was going to bring that up. Now, I think what something that's important to point out here is the Twitter CFO's account was compromised. They're saying the account was compromised on a bunch of different news sites. If he really was the victim of a drive-by password harvesting attack and was vulnerable to it, that means that he was not using Twitter's two-factor authentication, something that the company does suggest everybody use. And if your CFO isn't using your two-factor, that is a bad sign.
Well, isn't that how, not necessarily two-factor, but there were like five different things that tripped up the main guy in the Silk Road, the guy that was running that, and a lot of the things that he told everyone else to use while using the Silk Road, he didn't actually go and use himself. And one of those was just like an anonymizer.
Not registering the domain in your name.
Yeah, you know, don't do that. You know, they're just some silliness. Oh, and then the big thing was too, and I guess it sounds like Pete keeps trying to call him. The big thing that tripped him up was he actually had his hard drive encrypted. He had everything to where it would shut down once he closed the lid. Right. And the agents were actually able to get in and told all the people that were in the Silk Road, don't sit with your back to the door. You know, sit where you can see the entire room. And he didn't do that. And they came in, snatched the laptop away from him before he could do anything. And that's what the whole case was built on. Had he had time to shut the laptop lid, it would have been over. Right. And he was also logged into the Silk Road servers, one of the only two admins. So they had, now that's kind of, you know, I guess you could get like a bad agent that wouldn't know and be like, hey, you got the laptop closed. And it's like, there goes the whole case. But that's fairly impressive, you know, for them to come in and get that and know to maintain those things. Now, how they tripped him up is still kind of, you know, some of the ways that they found him, I think, might be a little bit gray. And they're not talking about some of those ways. But, you know, had he practiced what he preached, he would have been okay. Like
if he was as clever as all of his other efforts.
Yeah.
Well, it points out a really good point is that, you know, there's that saying in security circles. You guys are going to DEF CON. You know this. Perfect operational security is hard. It's impossible to maintain absolutely perfect, always doing everything right when it comes to all this computer stuff, because you've got your, you know, you might have different two-factor authentication systems on each one. You might have, you know, encrypted keys. You might use PGP for email. But, I mean, all that stuff is a pain in the butt to do.
Well, even if we, let's back that up even once. We're talking like that's user land in the application level. From a software developer perspective, we still don't know how to, you know, write good code. We don't know how to write bug-free code.
No.
You know, this is an industry issue. People, you know, a lot of people don't talk about it, but we just don't know how. So you get into, like, software assurance. It's really hard, and even then, we don't really know how to do it.
There's the one piece of code that I think that is probably the closest that qualifies to bug-free. There's a big Fast Company article about it, probably about 12 years ago now, is the main and backup space shuttle guidance software, which is produced under extremely rigid, very controlled circumstances. If there's a piece of software that could be said to be bug-free, it's that. And the article describing the coding practices and everything was a fascinating read. But unless you have, and no company has the time to do that kind of, you know, control on their software.
Well, it's dual development, and the way I understood it, they even had, you know, this is the way, if you had enough money, you should do everything. They had the development teams, the two design teams, work completely independent of each other,
yeah,
because the idea was that if someone
totally
got, like,
separate.
A bad idea and they talked, they could both go down that road, and then you've got both of the same systems failing when you needed complete, you know,
right.
diversity
yeah,
in the
totally,
systems.
Totally separate. But, you know, on the other side of that, you've got stuff like OpenSSL, the open SSL libraries that underlie, you know, all of the secure website communication, HTTPS, that everyone on the web uses, that just recently, middle of last year, was found to have numerous, just massive vulnerabilities that have been around for
yes,
years, and
yeah.
years and years.
But that's also, that's an open source thing. It's one guy, for the most part, maintaining
right.
it. I mean,
that's
Theo maintains it,
is,
you know, and he's done an excellent job, and he maintains OpenBSD and does all this
yeah,
amazing other work.
It's so. Crazy. It's crazy that there's stuff like that, that the software that is so foundational is maintained by, you know, a very... shockingly small number of
GPG
people.
Was the same way. So there was PGP,
yes,
which is
yes.
pretty good privacy, which, you know, back in the early days, it was pretty much the only game in town if you wanted to encrypt your email, and it does public key cryptography, and it's still around. Like, where I work, we
Symantec
do a lot of, yeah.
Right now, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so it changed hands a lot. There was an MIT licensed version of it. There's a lot of different stuff, but there is a GNU Privacy Guard, which is pretty much the same thing. It's the open source
it's
implementation.
GPG instead
GPG.
Of PGP.
Yeah. And, again, that's been maintained by a single person for a long
yeah.
time, and he actually was falling on dire straits. And every time Jay's having a conversation with Pete through
well,
real life
Pete,
emoticons.
Through emoji. Through emoji and
so
interpreting.
So I'm like, wow, Jay really likes what I'm saying. You're like, wow, Jay's telling me to shut down. And I look over, it's like, no, he's just doing stuff to Pete.
No, I was struggling to get on the Google Hangout, and I realized that I jumped on the Xfinity Wi-Fi, which was buggy. So Pete waved at me, and then he was frozen. For
like
the longest
it's like the
time.
End of Police Squad.
So let me ask you guys this, and this is something that popped up today. Like Jay came across a story where yet another, actually this was, you know, usually I guess it's like marketing companies and stuff like that ripping off, or, you know, web designers that take photographs that may not belong to them from the net and incorporate them into their designs. But there was like, I guess you probably tell the story better. There's an actual photographer. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to.
And I've got the wrap up question once you give
okay.
the whole.
Well, there's a thing that's going on right now that is really interesting in terms of copyright infringement, which is that people have, because of popular culture, want to be a photographer. They want to say, I am a photographer, and I want to do business as a photographer. Only
with,
one problem.
With my Instagram pictures?
Only one problem is that I can't take very good photographs. So what I will do is I will go to other good photographers' websites and cull their images and build a portfolio off of other people's work to market myself. So
or call it's called I can't take photographs, so I'll take photographs.
Exactly.
Wait, what do you mean? I am taking pictures. What?
I am taking pictures from. I took picture from that artist. So there's a website called Photo Stealers. And what this person does, and this person is a wedding photographer, what they do is they, now that they've built up a community, so people submit stuff that they find, because you could use Google Image Search, and you go to a photographer's website, and you say, well, those photographs are pretty good. Let me do a Google Image Search and see how many times they show up. And a lot of times, what will happen is they're all taken from, they might be taken from stock photo sites. But every now and then, they find them that have been taken from other photographers. So this person has this site set up, and so what happens is they'll broadcast, they'll say, okay, this person is stealing photos, here's their Facebook page, here's their website, here's the photo, here's the original photo that we found the original owner of, and then list all that out. And of course, like internet vigilantism likes to do, people say, hey, let's go after him. So they go start commenting on their Facebook page and calling them a bunch of, you know,
shame, shame,
shame. Exactly. And so these people will then either a number of different things will happen. First, they'll say, oh, crud, I've been caught. And they'll start pulling stuff down. In other situations, they'll say, you know, no, those are my photos that they, you know, those other people have stolen. And this one that I posted, the people said that hackers put the photos
and
up.
That's where I was going with that, is right. that everyone claims hackers. The person on this site, you know, they had, so she had a lot of
the whole hacker discussion.
Yeah. She had photos on, you know, they were obviously stolen from other places. This guy went and sourced the original photos, and she had gone so far as to actually cover up the original watermarks with her watermark.
And she tagged people in the photos, and people complimented the photos.
And she'd like, thanks. And created backstories for a lot of the photos, too, and gave, like, insights into the photo sessions and insights into the kids.
She could have just gone and taken her own photos.
Also, but here's the thing. So somewhere into the discussion online, like so many politicians and celebrities and all these other people, they claimed, I got hacked. And so how long is that going to continue to fly and be a valid excuse? And do people actually buy that? And is the understanding of how this whole hacking thing works, is that plausible to people? And is it plausible to people like her that she just says, I don't, because that would be an advanced persistent threat. Someone would really, really have to hate her and go after just her and go call all these other things and take the time to watermark them and take the time to do all this other stuff. And really,
so it's not
you're not
going
to break
hacking,
into Facebook.
It's cyberbullying.
It's cyberbullying.
Well,
really.
That's the thing that the people that they called out, the company that they found that was doing this, when they started, shining the light on it, the perpetrators claimed hacking, but then they claimed that that people were coming in and insulting the pictures of children, so they did go down the cyberbullying path.
But that never ever.
Well, they
did anyone ever find a place where someone said, "Hey, that kid has big ears"? Ha ha.
They nobody's found that just yet. Yeah. But what happens is on the internet, what happens is that, for example, if I was to make a Facebook page or a blog post that said I have been the victim of bullying or plagiarism or whatever, my friends would automatically assume that I am correct. That I have no reason to lie about this. So they will rally to my aid, which they did. In fact, when I had a similar situation happen. So what happens is that these people that are perpetrating these photographic frauds say, hey, photo stealers, it's actually called stopstealingphotos.com. If you want
to. Well, in their community, the only way for them to save face is to tell everyone, hey, these guys are coming after us. They're making this up.
And their friends tend to believe them. So they rally around their friend and they go and they, and that's what they've been doing is they've been retaliating. They found the person who runs the photo stealer site. They found that person's real name. They found their contact information. So they've gone out and started writing bad reviews about their company and the people that they've recruited to kind of join in the fight are just taking this one person's word on faith. So, I had somebody, in fact, that comes up with, at work, I think, on the same line of I've been hacked is that, I'm the victim of spyware. I'm the victim of malware. The reason that I have so many pornographic images on my company laptop is because spyware.
Of course. It's spyware that's doing it.
I've been hacked.
Spyware changed those watermarks. It's advanced spyware.
It's along those lines. I had a moment at a company I worked at long ago in the past, so I wouldn't have told the story if it wasn't long ago, but I was working in my office and a female executive came in to talk to me, and she picked the absolute worst moment, which is this place was kind of they didn't have lots of money.
Oh crud.
Oh no.
It looks like the company was listening.
They own our phone lines. It's AT&T.
Dun, dun, dun.
Sorry, Pete. You fell out.
He's still going.
No sound. We can't hear you.
They found you. Get out of the house.
Run.
Leave.
Run.
We can't hear you. Look at me. So, sorry, Pete. And apparently he can't hear me either.
Well,
so
speaking of technical glitches, while we're waiting for Pete, did you guys see that for about... for about 10 minutes this afternoon, the first 10 episodes of House of Cards was available on Netflix, season 3. There was a technical glitch, Netflix is calling it, and we're not exactly sure what. We sent emails in for comment, and Netflix hasn't given us any additional info. But for about 10 minutes, the first 10 episodes of season 3 of House of Cards, which isn't due to air until February
27th. Yeah, not being familiar, that's what I was asking. So this was like a pre-shipping issue.
Not supposed to air
issue.
Until February 27th. 10 of them went live, and they were up. And if you clicked at just the right time, you could watch a whole episode through, because once they pulled them down, even if you'd already been streaming, the stream would finish. So people who were people who happen to be, you know, using the internet in the middle of the day at, you know, 3 o'clock central or so for about 10 minutes, you would have been able to catch episodes of House of Cards way before it was supposed to air. Not sure what happened. Obviously, everything, they pre-stage all that stuff on their content servers. And it looks like somebody may have just dropped the wrong config file in.
I'm assuming that they probably have some, you know, back admin panels to where you don't have developers going and loading movies.
Yeah.
Probably have content managers, and probably someone just clicked the wrong thing or put in the wrong date or didn't type in, like, okay, don't release until this date, and they realized it right away. But I bet it took some time to publish and get to all the cache servers.
And then it did. I managed to catch the first episode. No spoilers, but it was very good.
But if you had an autoplay, would it jump to the second episode automatically, or would it time you out? Would it be like, that ride's over?
So what it did with mine is I started playing the first episode, and it was playing, and I got all the way through it, and at the very end, they had already pulled them. And if you kept watching, if you didn't close your window, the stream would complete. So I got through the whole first episode, but then it went back to, like, the main... It went back to the suggestion window, and you couldn't replay any of the other ones. So that was that's kind of a big leak. But interestingly enough, they kind of rolled with it. So shortly after it happened, the official House of Cards Twitter account they posted a message on there, and the message says, "This is Washington. There's always a leak." So rather than trying to react all badly about it, and they just sort of rolled with it. And you know, if you managed to catch an episode, you got a nice sneak peek. The rest of it will come on in a couple of weeks. But I thought that was cool.
I like companies owning up to that, not calling you hacked or calling whatever.
Right, that's kind
of cool. Like, there's an Irish airline. We probably can't say exactly what happened, but I think some of their crewmen decided to have a little bit of fun and draw something out in the snow underneath one of the planes. And then Ryanair, I think they took on to Twitter and said, you know, it's great. While we don't, you know, we didn't hire these guys for their artistry, and it's obviously, we apologize, it's obviously a plane missing some wings.
Yes, they left the wings off of their airplane.
So yeah, that's a little bit of humor and just, you know, kind of confronting it. And you know, in this case, I know a little bit about what the show's premise is. Doing that segue, that's the good way to handle it.
So that was the technical glitch story.
They should actually have the main actor do a thing about it, like he does for those commercials.
Kevin Spacey. Yeah.
Can we hear you now, Pete?
Are you alive, Peter?
Hopefully. I don't know what happened.
So you looked very animated.
You were the
story.
Energizer Bunny. He kept telling and telling and telling. It was awesome. Yeah,
I can't tell. You know, basically, when I'm talking, there's not sound coming from your end.
Right. Well, I was trying to, like, put my hands to my ears. Can't hear you.
Do this. This is.
I should have got that thing. that says, shut up. They're listening. No, so you were talking about the company.
Just start over.
We're fairly sure the company came in, intercepted the call, and squelched your voice on the
long
story.
Long story short is that this company went to have the software that you had to have to do your job. Your boss would basically say, "Well, I guess you're going to have to go out and get that software." Wink. And so the places where you would go to get that.
Did you have to sail the high seas to get that software?
You had to put on an eye patch and wave a black flag. And the biggest thing was actually software that we already had, but we didn't have the keys for. We didn't have the, you know, some of it, I don't know if they owned it and didn't have the keys, or if they just had, you know, if they had never had the keys. But when you go to the sites to get the serial numbers that'll work on some software, especially old software, when you finish getting the key, when you hit OK, then it pops up. The way they make their money is advertising pornographic websites. And I don't know if you heard the part at the beginning, but basically a female executive had come into – the developers were all in an area that was closed off, and the air conditioner had broken. So, I mean, it's like Murphy's Law stacked up on me that day.
Oh my gosh.
The door was open because the air conditioner on the area was broken.
We had to take our clothes off because it was really hot.
Right.
No, fortunately not that. But otherwise, the door would have been locked. And when she came to talk to me,
and there was
I
nowhere
would have
else
been
to,
able to.
There was nowhere else to put the donkey, so the donkey was in your office.
right. And so, but so, you know, the timing. So she walks up, I'm getting this key for real work, and the stuff pops up. And what is your reaction? You're going to minimize the stuff as quickly as possible because hopefully you figure if I can cover this, and she walks out, then everybody's happy and nobody's embarrassed. Long story short, the next day I walked in and, you know, everybody's all like quiet and watch you walk by like a
like dead man walking. dead
like
man
it's
walking.
Real creepy, like they're watching you like you're some kind of, you know,
pervert.
Sexual pervert. And then I got called into my boss and his boss's office, and his boss was there, and they said, you know, that this person had said, you know, basically that there had been a complaint and all that. So I asked who it was, and it was the person with that. And they you could see they were sort of shocked because I was relieved. It's like, oh, hey, no, I can explain this. And then I told my boss, it's like, okay, you know, remember I had to get blah, blah, blah software. And I said, call up this website. You know, he turned his computer around. He typed in the address. I said, okay, go to the thing for the serial number. And he did it. And I said, now click OK.
Boom.
And he clicked it, and boom. And then they were relieved as well.
Everybody's, you know, fired.
Basically, they thought, well, no, because then they knew I wasn't. There wasn't anything untoward going on that, right, couldn't result in them going to jail.
Well, I mean, other than the software piracy, which
once,
I guess
once it was clear. Well, once it was clear that I wasn't a pervert and that I was doing it at their behest, they couldn't very well can.
No, they can't can you for you.
For not installing a pop-up blocker?
But they could throw you under the bus.
They could, because they could call the BSA. BSA could call in your...
Yeah, you are kind of complicit in installing that software.
You could have an audit, which we've
had. Well, there is the company that is being sued by Adobe.
Mm-hmm.
The Fadge, what's the name?
Not Forever 21. Forever 21?
Well, they deserve it.
Forever 21 has been using Adobe software for all of their work for a long time, unlicensed, and they've been called out
into
on
print
it.
Media and into web media,
and they've
like
been
publicly,
called out on it by Adobe.
This
and
isn't
they
like
didn't stop.
It's not like college student. I'm going to get some experience with Photoshop.
No.
I guess I'll pirate it and buy it one day. This is a major corporation making tremendous revenue with pirated software. That's bad. I mean,
it's because they're 21 and they think they'll live
forever.
And they do.
This is forever legally tried as an adult is what that is. That's...
But
well, it's, I think, you know, when it comes to your internet habits at home, I'm a big fan of that. I want to get one of those medical alert bracelets that says delete my browser history. but when you're at work, you need to realize that, you know, that stuff is not private. And even like if you're going to those sites to download keys or pirate software or whatever, all
which
of that,
you shouldn't do. Don't ever do that.
All of that information is saved in your history, wherever you go on the net and whatever you do. And if the company's really freakish about it, they're monitoring all that at the server level.
So I'd say that's pretty easy to do. I mean, no matter what you think you're doing, you know, people at work, if there's an admin at work and they have, you know, anything above like your small office, home office kind of network kit, they can actually pull up. They can see all the packets. They can see everywhere you're going. They can probably see what you're typing, you know, or at least typing into the browser. So, yeah, that's not safe.
Now, it doesn't mean you need to sit there and be paranoid because they're watching you 24/7, but all that information is collected. So.
And generally, speaking from someone in IT, when we go looking for people, it's, you know, if we get any kind of, you know, and we haven't done this in a while, but any kind of MPA or if any outsiders come and say, hey, we see this kind of traffic originating from your site. And also, if you're streaming video, if, you know, suddenly, why is the network slower? We get reports of, like, who are the biggest bandwidth users?
Pull up MRT.
Yeah, and everyone else is using maybe like, you know, a few hundred megs a day, and there'll be a few users,
you know,
10 gigs.
Don't
like, what
submit
are you doing?
A ticket to the help desk because your computer no longer resolves Pirate Bay. Come on.
Did someone do that?
I've had that happen.
I've had people complain about the fact that they're asking for some ports to be opened up on the firewall, and they were all torrent ports or blocked.
My torrent client can't connect anymore. Could you open up those?
Well, they try to be sneaky about it. They try to, like, you know.
I need it for a project.
I need OpenBSD. OpenBSD is one of the few things that just, you know, distributes stuff over torrents. There are a few open source software projects that use, you know, torrents, and that's legit. But the majority of traffic that I see when we stiff, you know, network traffic for torrents.
Stiff.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, actually,
all,
that's oops, slip of the.
All torrent traffic is Linux ISOs.
A lot, no, there is. There's no good use for it.
There, but,
there is, but when we sniff the traffic and we see what's going on, it's usually songs and it's other stuff.
One thing I'm glad has changed. I believe it's changed, been changed for a long time. But remember back in the day, in the late 90s, when you would go to help somebody because they had a problem with their browser, which often was that they didn't know how to use it. But then when you went to browser history, it would actually open up the folder and show the photographs that were in their browser cache. Which doesn't really happen anymore. But so you're helping some old guy or some relative or executive or whatever, and you go, you're trying to help them with their browser problem, and then it's like, my looks like you have more than a browser problem here. Now at least you can help with their browser; it won't like display all that.
You have to play the game. I don't see that.
Now I will say that because of spyware, there is it does call into question whether or not the person was up to anything. It used to be if somebody had their computer was infected with a lot of pornographic spyware, they were using the company computer to go to sites that were probably not sites you should visit when you're at work. But today, unfortunately for the IT department, there are some, you can get spyware from a legitimate
site. Yeah, the big thing now is to break into, servers that maybe aren't all that closely watched of legitimate businesses, and then not deface the server, not tear it down, not hose it, but go in, lace it with programs you want to, be there, and then unbeknownst to anyone, you hide your stuff well, and everyone that goes to that site, totally, it could be a gardening site, it could be, anything that's completely legit, right, but not a large enough corporation where they, they've got a dedicated security team. You've got whatever that site had.
Well, also you've got, what I've seen, I haven't been able to isolate it, but, you've got webmasters who are accepting content from advertisers. So somebody will say,
that's bad.
So
yeah.
I'm going to give you some
JavaScript enable ads.
Right. And I'm going to go ahead and embed some nasty code in there. And then the webmaster for CNN or whatever says, okay, we got the ad revenue. Let's post this to the website.
Didn't Forbes just have that happen to them?
Yeah.
I think they did.
But, you see it where people are going to legitimate websites or because they've got something else going on with their computer, they're resolving a different site than where they think they're going, and boom, the computer's infected and it's bad. So it's a really untenable situation for IT and HR when it comes to how computers are being used. I remember when I worked at Compaq, they monitored everything just in over the local network in real time, and like if you did anything that was outside of the IT policy, they would literally come up to your desk, tap you on the shoulder, and walk you out.
Yep. Yeah, big companies
will do that. Well, sometimes though you expect the net, the thing that's gonna stop a problem. I was working my CubeMate, I came back from lunch and I had those like milk carton shaped deals of malted milk balls. Whoppers?
Yes, yes.
And so he goes, Whoppers, Whoppers.com. He types it in and hits go. And this is at a like Fortune 500 company. So the thing you would expect is if there's a problem with the site
blocked
on the content, then it would essentially pop up the thing that says, bad site, don't go here.
Right.
No, instead it pretty well showed the site and it was what you would expect for Whoppers if all the pictures were of
Burger King
sandwiches? large women
Burger King sandwiches without,
eating Burger King
yeah without tops on. And so it was just, which the extra funny part was that this person happened to be of the gay persuasion, so it didn't work on so many fronts for this one, but he basically figured he was going to get the site for malted milk balls, and if he didn't, there would be a block if it was going to be a problem, and instead he got embarrassed.
You should never blindly type just gibberish into anything.
Well, you should. You should do it on someone else's computer.
But the thing about that is it just doesn't, you would think this was, because this was the late 90s, this was when all the domains, when they'd gotten down to where there were like five that were single word domains that weren't owned by somebody, and you kind of by then expected that the company with the trademark would have, Burger King, if it had been a Burger King site, if it rerouted to Burger King, that would have made sense. Or if it had gone to the malted milk ball site.
So there was no distinct business purpose for him to visit that site, so.
No, but it was in the record. Yeah. it was recorded for that. But they didn't, apparently after some investigation of that kind of stuff, I heard unofficially from someone who would be in a position to know that the list of attempts to go to sites that you shouldn't go to was just loaded with high-end executive names because you had to sign in to go on the internet, and that apparently was why a blind eye was turned to basically any of the kind of poor site-visiting judgment that had gone on at that place.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Shenanigans.
So it's the everyone does it argument, I guess, which seems to be, isn't that kind of where we are now? I how do you how do you really screen for it? It seems like nobody's doing the Nannyware thing. Doesn't seem to be happening that much anymore. I don't know if there's still a lot of IT places that do it. You know, they used to sign up with services who would who would block the sites that you shouldn't go to.
Yeah, you'd have some of them be subscription services for blacklists or whatever.
There's still some out there, but they exist in the corporate realm. They like still, SonicWall, yeah. Dell bought SonicWall. SonicWall has some stuff that
they
ties
still
in.
Do that, but yeah, they're usually at corporate level. They're boxes that sit in the network stack, and your request at the first request gets sent over to it. And it looks up the IP and then compares it to a blacklist that gets updated frequently.
Yeah, we can even come in and on our software we can block certain categories. Like even, for instance, it says sports and we can block like gambling sites, or we can open up like we've got people traveling to the Masters, sales guys going to the Masters, so we can unblock Masters and we unblock golf, but we're gonna block football and block basketball. So, it's pretty fine grained, and then they go out, they supposedly sweep the sites.
See, we just recently changed ours, and it went from I would say fairly loose to pretty tight. So, all of a sudden, like, a lot of sites that I try to go to...
You can't go to whitehouse.com anymore?
That one actually is legit now, I think.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I would hope so.
That's
I mean,
like a really old
guys.
Joke, too.
No, I think a few years ago, it actually goes to the .gov site now, I think.
We could do it on the KPFT internet here real quick. Let's check that out.
I think that one got fixed after, and this is a true story, after basically the first lady, Laura Bush, at the time... with a group of people, something at the White House, a tour or whatever, typed in whitehouse.com and got an eyeful of what you got at whitehouse.com.
It's not a porn site, but it goes to like a domain squatter site. So it's got a picture of the White House on there and like a little search bar, but there's no...
So I wonder what the asking price is that, the U.S. government hasn't bought that.
The U.S. government has its own top-level domain. U.S. government
has .gov. I mean, just to save face, if someone had,
Well, I heard a story of, I wasn't paying attention completely.
I would just
to the conversation,
seize it.
But didn't somebody from the White House want to show some visitors the website?
That's
the
what,
White
yeah,
House?
That's what Pete was just saying. He's saying possibly.
Yeah, Laura Bush, the first lady at the time.
It's whitehouse.gov. Use that .gov domain. No one else can.
They could just seize it.
No, that's what I'm saying.
I don't think you can, because it's under the control of VeriSign. VeriSign is not a wholly U.S.-based entity.
Time out here. So the NSA can go spy on everyone, collect everything. They can do get away with murder. They can spy on everything, but they can't get a domain.
They seized First Row Sports.
Immigration and Customs can do that through, I guess they interoperate
with
VeriSign.
That's what I'm saying. So,
they do that, yeah.
So they could just seize that domain through the proper channels.
Well, but didn't that was like a... like an Argentinian or a Chilean sports site that happened to, right? That First Row Sports, when they did that, the one you were just talking about?
I don't remember. I think the one they seized was a .us.
Well, what's,
no,
what
they,
is First
they keep
Row?
Moving. It's a site that aggregates video streams of all kinds of sports that you can't watch locally. So, or some of them you can watch locally because they just, it's everything. Soccer, football,
basketball, I thought it was a non-U.S. site specifically.
Well, but I think they had U.S. domain. They had a bunch of domains, and they seized the domains that were in .com or .us or something. But then they moved to .eu domain and a .. There's a bunch of different domains now.
Well, and when you say seized, I don't think they didn't seize possession of the domain. My understanding is they were able to have – they did it with DNS. It was a DNS thing. They didn't change the record ownership. They just did a DNS redirection off of – so that the A records for that site pointed to the ICE servers with the ICE logo.
But the thing is, I think that they do that in cooperation with VeriSign.
I don't know.
I believe they do.
We're all talking speculation at this point. But this is a great thing to look at, though. Maybe we should look it up.
Because I'm pretty sure I've read articles from people that don't want to buy domain names where the top-level domain is controlled by... for example, VeriSign.
Well, but it's not, isn't it?
Because it's
a
U.S. company, and so...
Wasn't there just a shift, though? Like, VeriSign ceded it all back to ICANN, and ICANN now is running everything?
Well, I can't tell the U.S. courts that the top-level domain records are not property. That was a big thing that came out of that.
Okay, I know there was
something. And that was, like, this summer, I think.
It's a little bit of an esoteric conversation to have, I know, but the intricacies of how the domain name system works and how the global internet name system works are actually fascinating.
That was one of the things that people were flipped out about because, you know, if you know, you have whatever.com and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to protect this because I'm going to put my name servers in Algeria or wherever.
Wherever.
It doesn't matter because the .com comes from the root servers and .com is controlled by VeriSign or whoever.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. government doesn't have to go to you, doesn't have to go to your name servers because they can get it from the one above you.
Or they can just go to, the other way they can do it is they could go to different ISP name servers. They can poison the DNS at the ISP level.
They could poison at the ISP level, but that's not going to get very many
people. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, that's thousands and thousands of servers.
Or poison at the root. But that's why there are 13 root servers that are across the globe. And this is, we could probably do a whole show on DNS and the
DNS is broken right now. And that's one of the things that people are pushing for is, DNSSEC is, secure DNS and just
I wouldn't say they're really pushing.
Well, yeah. I think we need something like that.
It's difficult to implement, so not very many people have done it.
Well, DNSSEC is hard. So I use Amazon AWS for my domain's DNS. I use Amazon's Route 53 service for DNS rather than using my registrars because it's great. It's super easy to deal with and it's like dirt cheap. But Amazon Route 53, for as awesome as it is, and it gives you worldwide replication and everything. You get name servers in four different continents. They don't support DNSSEC because it's too complicated to roll out at the level that they've got DNS support at. And that's a huge roadblock. They do DNS for tons of stuff. I had two main registrars I was dealing with. One supported DNSSEC and one didn't. I've left the one that didn't support it, but I don't use them for my DNS anyway because I try to keep all that segregated. DNSSEC's complicated. That's another thing we could do a whole show on because the weird thing about DNSSEC, for listeners who don't know what we're talking about, there's DNS, domain name services, and it's sort of that's the thing that operates like the phone book when you look up an internet address, when you type, kpft.org, it's .org, right? When you type the kpft.org into your web browser and hit enter.
Oh, don't go to kpft.com.
your computer uses through a complicated system called DNS, it correlates kpft.com or .org, I'm sorry, now I'm doing it, the address with the actual number, the IP address that corresponds to the servers where the website's hosted. That's a very simplified version. DNS is a hugely complicated system, and it has a lot of inherent flaws. Like most internet technologies, it was developed in a time when everyone was expected to be friendly and openness was prized above security and interoperability was the order of the day. So DNS has issues, sort of inherent issues. So there is some effort to develop a follow-on technology to DNS called DNSSEC, SEC, with the SEC standing for security. And DNSSEC incorporates encryption, incorporates symmetric or asymmetric key encryption, public key cryptography, and essentially has ways built into it to make sure that if I have a website, you can tell because I use DNSSEC that the DNS entries for that website are the entries that I made, and you can verify that cryptographically. That's the
simple way to think of it. Think of it like, and this is a way oversimplification, but think of it like SSL for the DNS lookup. There's, it verifies this is what it is.
It's
digitally
signed,
a lot of the same underpinnings as that. So I do think we need something easier to use, but that's the whole thing. There's nothing, a lot of that is based on trust, and you can get someone that can go out there and play rogue DNS server, like Lee mentioned before, DNS poisoning, and it's very easy to direct people to different sites. And a lot of attacks, that's one of the low-hanging pieces of fruit that people can go after is they can go mess with someone's DNS records and either send a whole lot of traffic to a site or divert traffic
Very high profile compromise just a year ago that I wrote about that did that. They stole some guy's Twitter account by hacking into his DNS registrar and redirecting his MX records, his mail server records, and then doing an I forgot my password thing. And because they had changed the MX lookup, they
sent it
they
somewhere
received
else,
the message,
caught the mail, and
caught the mail,
they were
did
in
the password reset.
Even locally, Jay Lee was talking earlier about, the IT folk can sniff traffic and see where people are going. There are packages that I can run that, if Lee was to make like a DNS request, I can actually grab that packet off the net, shape it, give them a different answer and send it right back, to where even though I'm not monkeying with a DNS server, I'm still, as far as Lee's concerned, I'm redirecting his traffic.
I do that.
Actually, that's what a lot of the NSA is into. This is what the NSA does to a lot of people, is to get them to be able to load up NSA spyware and do things like that. They've got a few different tools that will reroute browsers and reroute traffic to their servers. They load up the packages that they need, and they just let it go on back. So it's kind of old tricks.
And that is called a
503 redirect. Well, no, so that's a redirect. Yeah, man in the middle too, depending on how you do it.
But I do that at work because
you're an elite hacksaw.
Well, because I control the DNS for our environment pretty much. So, and we have complicated routing and agreements with a number of other organizations, and so sometimes people need to get to external facing sites for other places, and sometimes they need to get to internal sites, and so we sometimes poison our DNS for certain names so that externally you would get a different IP than you would get if you go against our internal DNS servers to look up that.
Yes. And I run split brain DNS at home too. I have a bind 9 server, and I do split brain DNS at the house so that I can have my own records and also have external records and get to my web. Anyway, now we're getting way far afield from, and I guess we're getting close to the end of the hour here. It's 10 till, it looks like.
Yeah, we
plenty of time.
Yes. Right.
For another
keep
6
on
minutes.
Talking, Lee.
Keep going.
All right.
When you hear the music.
You won.
Is split brain DNS, that's a Windows thing, I'm assuming?
No, it's just I run a DNS server.
I think
server
he's making
internally.
Stuff up.
No, I run a DNS server internally, and I have records for my domain, my bigdinosaur.org. That's the domain.
Okay, but it's Windows. It's Windows.
No, it's just split DNS.
Okay.
Basically, it's basically your.
I've heard split, but split brain DNS. Is that a branding term for Windows?
Always heard it called. I have my own internal.
I always call it split DNS.
Split DNS.
I've never
basically
heard split
have,
brain.
You have internal DNS and external DNS.
I have no Windows boxes in my house. I'm Windows free. It's a good life. So split DNS then. I have my own IP address entries on my DNS server at home, so I can type my domain and go to the internal side of my web server or my mail server or whatever. But then there are external entries in Route 53, so I can do it from here too, and it goes to the same box.
Not to be confused with Route 53.
Route 53.
That's
Route 53 is that cool encryption algorithm you wrote.
See, split DNS exists because. Back in the day when everybody trusted everybody, most companies had one DNS server or one set. Well, they usually have one DNS, but they had one set of DNS servers. And those servers hosted their authoritative DNS zones and also did their recursion and also was open to the world for the authoritative answers. But the recursion was also open to the world. And it wasn't really a big deal until hackers started abusing it in a number of ways. So people started to have split DNS, so they would have authoritative externals that don't do any recursion, not even for themselves. They're in the DMZ, they're actually external to the company. And then they would have internal DNS servers that would do recursion, would do caching. They might have internal authoritative zones as well that are different than their external zones.
I just do it so I can type www or mail dot, so I can use the same FQDNs inside on my LAN and outside.
But get local traffic instead of through external.
Exactly.
I've had to do similar for for some small businesses that I've dealt with where they have their internal servers, but they also, use their laptops and go outside, and not wanting to have to explain to all their users how to distinguish. Basically, I've just made it where the internal DNS for those particular servers is gives the local IP, and then if they're outside, obviously their DNS is going to come from their provider, and then they'll get the externals.
You can also do that. I mean, companies do that because if you have a lot of people internally, if you provide an internal address, it cuts down on the traffic that goes through your entire network, sandwiched through the firewall and everything else.
So everywhere I see split brain, it's popping up in MSDN articles
in that
and IC Windows
I've been
Pro.
Misusing the term. For
No. You're using it. I think you're fine. I just think that split brain is like that's the nomenclature
Microsoft.
From Windows world. So if you go into Active Directory, if you sit for like your, the whatever the network of the MCSD is, MCSE. That's probably on the test. MCX. So that's. I was just curious because I'd never heard that, but I Googled for it, and it's all these Windows sites. So it looks like it's an Active Directory term.
I must have.
We need to purify you, Lee. Yeah,
purify me by fire.
I'm going to call Stallman.
Burn it out of me. I'll show you something over the break. Hopefully, we'll redeem me.
Oh no, I trust. I know what you. I know what you're on at home. This is not stalkery, but when y'all posted pictures of your workplaces, yeah, I printed it out and put it up on my bed.
You didn't see my.
I didn't actually. All right, but I've seen his workplace. So I've got respect for your setup and what you run. I'm just saying that is a very Microsoft tainted word. That's all I'm saying.
I'm going to stop using it forever. So.
All right. So
say Split Horizon. That's more Unixy.
That sounds cool.
Sorry, Jen.
Reining things in just a little bit, you know, as we approach the top of the hour and we get ready for our break.
It's pretty nerdy. It was pretty nerdy even for this show, I think.
I'm happy with that. I'm content to, you know, alienate our
most of our listeners.
Who alienated us during the last fun drive. So, you know, turnabout's fair. No, I mean, I think we should feel free to talk. You know, we do need to rein it in, and we do need to keep things accessible as much as we can. But I like going off on a nerd tangent and talking about some of the deeper levels. So I think people are interested in that.
If anybody wants to call in and talk about DNS, man, we can do that.
If anyone wants to call in with a domain name, we'll give you the IP address.
True distributed DNS lookups.
I don't use DNS. I just memorize IPv6 addresses.
We'll resolve it through at least three different servers.
Is there an RFC for like distributed radio based DNS lookups?
No, we've got Tracer T and we're not afraid to use it. Mm-hmm.
Tracer T.
Pin G.
But we're also going to give different answers, and you'll have to tell how authoritative the real answer
we're
is. Cloud.
James probably sounds the most authoritative.
We're going to Cloudflare it. You know, some people are going to resolve certain IP addresses. Other people are going to resolve other IP addresses.
Some of them, you might get poisoned.
Some of them might be inside a firewall. Some of them might be outside a firewall. But as we do approach the top of the hour, we get ready to do some station business. Coming up in the second hour of Technology Bites, do we have a Barrett time?
This is the last time we won't have a Barrett time, but I think Pete has some weird science for us.
All right.
So I think he's going to dress up like Kelly.
It's alive!
Kelly, what was her name?
Kelly Brock.
Yes.
I think we could have some new dwarf animated GIFs if you want.
I'm going to write a Barrett time real quick. Then.
New dwarf or something. All right, so what we're going to do is, I think it was a good conversation the first hour. We had some stuff on the list to talk about because Pete does a show prep thing, but if we can't get Pete on the air and have him guide us, we're kind of on our own. So I think we did a good job, you know, rescuing victory from the jaws of defeat there. So we're going to take a short break here and take care of some station business, and we'll come back for another hour of Technology Bites. So that is what you're listening to. If you didn't know, this is Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Groovehouse.
This month, KPFT will be convening focus groups to get listener opinions on the station, from programming to pledge drive. Whether you're a member or not, we want to know what you think about what we do well and where we can improve. If you want to participate in focus groups in February, please visit kpft.org. You will fill out a short contact form and then be added for consideration. We will select a mix of KPFT listeners to meet, so your completion of optional demographic information is appreciated. To participate in KPFT focus groups this month, just visit kpft.org. It's smart to act now, as they are invitation-only gatherings. Thank you. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Did you know know you can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. We now return you to the gardening show.
So when you dig your hands into the soil and you find that, you know, it's filled with earthworms.
So dirty.
I've got root.
You are Groot.
I am Groot.
You are Groot.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Bok, bok. So what is that? Lee was showing me an app. What is that you were playing with, Duo?
Yeah, it's a thing I started fiddling with. It's a paid service if you're big, but it's a free service if you're not big.
What do you mean by big?
Like a company. A big company with employees. It's a two-factor authentication. There's lots of methods of doing two-factor authentication, right?
Well, let's explain what two-factor authentication
is. Yes, that is. So most things, you know, it's one factor. It's all about what you have. So you talk about like one-factor authentication. It's like something you have. So it's either something you have, which could be a fob or a key to your house or something you know, like a password.
Primarily, it's just your password. Like you go to a website.
That's the easiest thing to do. It's something, yeah. So what two-factor authentication does, it opens it up to something you know and also something you have.
Or something you are.
Yeah. Right. In this case,
like a fingerprint.
Yeah, like a fingerprint or biometrics. But yeah, I don't like my thumbs being cut off.
Retinal scan.
With two factor. Yeah, and even I think that could maybe be faked a little bit. People have DNA. Taken DNA. I don't like that.
All right, not too much of a tangent.
Yeah, not too much of a tangent. Anyway, so
mustache size.
Adding
style.
I'm pro that. two-factor authentication is just adding another piece of information required to log into your account. So, for instance, if someone gets one piece of that authentication, which is usually your password, so someone steals your password, they couldn't log into your email, they couldn't get into your bank account if you had two-factor authentication. And the easiest way to do two-factor authentication is to have something on you that you usually have, which is your cell phone, and you can get an app, and the app will tie into, and you know, in this case, let's use Google as an example. You can say, hey, I want to do two-factor authentication in Google for Gmail, and anytime you try to log into Gmail from a new computer, you know, for the first time, you have to go to your phone and type in a code that your phone gives you, and that code rotates about every 30 to 60 seconds. So that is two factors. The nice thing is, it's like, yes, you still have to have your password, but you know, you could write down your password and give it to a complete stranger, and they couldn't do anything without it unless they also got your cell phone from you.
Right. Or beat you with a rubber hose.
So if somebody really comes nice up and setup. Gives you their password in person, beat them up and take their cell phone.
That's yes, well, yeah, yes. Get both.
So the idea is that, for example, my Gmail account, I have that tied to a number of different accounts, like my bank account and so forth. So, like, if I want to do a recovery on a password for my bank account, they're going to send it to my Gmail. So I don't want people...
It's the most secure account. It's your holy of holy as far as email accounts go.
So I don't want people to be able to get into my Gmail. So even if they were to compromise my password for my Gmail, because of two-factor authentication, if you try to log into if I gave you my Gmail password and you tried to log in, it's not going to let you get in there.
Because
there's a secondary layer of authentication that you have to go through. And one of the ways to do that is use this application that generates a code.
It's called TOTP, Timed One-Time Pad Authentication, for the Google Authenticator, the method they use.
Right. So when I go to, if I lose all of my hardware and I get on an internet kiosk and I want to log into my Gmail to get something, I have to at least have my phone. And if I lost my phone, I'd really be in a world of hurt. So you can actually print out one-time passwords.
Yes, recovery codes.
Recovery codes that you can carry with you. Now, if somebody gets a hold of that and your password, of course, you're in trouble. But the reality is that, you know...
Or keep them at home, put them in a safe, make a couple printouts of them. That's what I do. I keep a copy of mine at work, a copy of mine at home. I don't put them in my wallet and walk around with them, because if someone got my wallet, that's the same thing as...
I emailed it to myself.
You do want... I mean, if you have accounts, Google is a good example of an account that offers two-factor authentication. You have your password, like Jay was saying, and you also have, you install an app on your phone. It's a, there's an iOS app, there's an Android app. It's for Google's case, it's the Google Authenticator app, and it generates. It's sort of like a software version of those old RSA key fobs that everybody used to carry around.
They're still around for banking. Yeah. I mean, we carry them at IT, and that's why I didn't know about the Authenticators, because we'd always just had the hardware ones, which is cool. It looks cool, but it's another thing to go in your pocket, another thing to lose. You know.
So it's the same deal. If you have using Gmail, Google as an example, you go log in your Gmail, you type in your username, type in your password, hit the login button, and then you get a second box, and the second box is like, now you type in your one-time password. So you pull up your Authenticator app, you look at Google, and it'll have a number, and the number cycles every 30 seconds, and you type that in. It's an added layer of security so that, like what happened to the Twitter CFO, if your account is compromised, if somebody ganks your password, you're not necessarily going to be able to log in. And Google is not the only service that does it. Dropbox, if you use Dropbox, they have two-factor authentication. And a lot of these services will use Google's Authenticator app for the exact same kind. So you have one app, and in that app, you would have, you know, I've got a bunch of different ones in mine. You've got, you know, 10 different little one-time passwords. And then obviously you have to make sure you're protecting your phone, too. Whatever has the app, so you want to make sure you've got a password on your phone, or if you have an iPhone, you're using the thumbprint unlock thingy if it supports it. You never want to have your phone with all this two-factor security on it without at least just a simple passcode on it. Although those aren't really worth very much.
I mean, we saw the 5-year-old girl that circumvented her dad's, you know, iPhone within the first few hours just by, you know, taking it up to your sleeping dad on the couch and, you know, pressing up against
So here's my story. Right. After the Geek Gathering on Friday, which was good, by the way, thanks for everyone coming out, I got up on Saturday morning and I could not find my phone. And the first thing that washes
over... Here it is. It's right here.
Yeah. The first thing that washes over you is like, oh, crud, my phone is gone, my data. And then you relax a little bit because you realize your phone is password protected, so nobody's getting into it if they find it. So then you just go to the point where it's like, well, crud, I lost my phone. So I'm going to have to replace it. But first, let's go online and use Find My iPhone to see if we could figure out if I really did leave it there. Mm-hmm. And I went on to iCloud and I did the Find My Phone, and my phone did not show up. So I said, crud, somebody's got my phone and they've turned it off. But I found it was still listed, and it said, you know, you can send stuff to it when it's found, or, you know, get a notification when it's found, or you can send a sound to it anyway, even though we don't know where it is. Mm-hmm. And so I sent the sound, and I heard the sound.
Ah, that can be the best sound
Jay,
of your
did
life.
You eat your phone again?
Not again. No, so I heard the sound, and I'm sitting at my desk in my office at home, and I hear the sound, and it's behind me. So I rotate in my chair, and it's behind me. And I rotate in my chair, and I get up, and it's behind me. Oh. And I'm looking around, and my phone is in my, where I never put it, in my back pocket.
Wow.
Plus the two-factor pat-down authentication, because it was in my wallet pocket. I patted my pockets and didn't find it because that's my wallet. So normally I'd pat my two front pockets, and it took me a minute. I had just woken up too, so I was like a dog chasing his digital tail.
Have you found your glasses yet?
somebody, I posted it to Facebook, you know, the experience, and somebody mentioned the fact that they were freaking out talking to somebody on their phone because they couldn't find their phone. Like, it's got to be here somewhere.
Can you call me? Hold on, I got another call.
I can see that. I can see myself doing something like that.
I mean, I count on my phone for so much. Like, I have alarms set to remind me to take my medication and things like that.
Come and do the show.
Remember Lee's name. Son!
You got it right the past few times. I'm proud of you, Jay.
I try. All right, so getting back, so we have no Barrett time, so we're going to do a weird science. Is that what we're going to do?
So says Pete. Yeah, I don't want to speak.
Do we want to do weird science, or do we want to do try by or fry?
It's alive.
It's your call. We're going to leave it in your hands.
We'll leave weird science. We can do a little farther in the hour, maybe. And I guess the short and quick news before I do the first try by or fry. For those of you who've just been sitting waiting, wondering what happened this week while I wasn't listening to Technology Bites, No, I've just got a few quickies, so I'll throw them out there. One is there's a report from Reuters that found that smartphone theft, especially of iPhones, has dropped dramatically because of Apple's decision to implement a remote kill switch via Find My Phone. They found that iPhone theft dropped by 50% in London, 40% in San Francisco, and 25% in New York. And that's before Apple made it default turned on. Basically, they made it optional, and it's changed the theft rate. Which the only sad thing about that story is the cell phone. This means the cell phone companies still, you know, AT&T, Verizon, etc. They still haven't done anything about phone theft. Even though they have the like ID of the phone and all that, they had all that information, and they actually would, like, if somebody brought a stolen iPhone into them, they would, if you set up an account, they would actually go ahead and, you know, if you said, oh, you know, my uncle gave me this, and then they would set you up with the phone and give you a SIM and off you go. But so kudos to Apple for putting in this kind of security, and the result is that there's less theft. So. Good on them. A couple other quickie Apple things. Apparently, iOS 9, Apple's working on it, but they've already announced it. Essentially, it's not going to have a bunch of new features. They are going to try and make it, quote, bulletproof.
I would like to see that. That
is not a bad idea. It's good timing.
That, it kind of ties back with if you remember OS 10.6 Snow Leopard, when they were like, no new features, just better features. So I hope that's the same thing.
Yeah, it seems to make sense. I mean, I guess, or, you know, because it's sort of either that or do the, like, Microsoft, no, let's add 1,000 new features, and then we'll say it's more secure because at least 100 of those features have to be secure.
So if when they make it bulletproof, will it be waterproof too?
No.
The hardware?
No, only bulletproof.
Only bulletproof. Okay. That's still not bad.
And it's only bulletproof, not Barrett-proof.
Right.
And then the other ones are ones that aren't that big a deal, and I'm not going to waste time with them. So now on Try Buy or Fry, this one's news, but you know it'll be interesting to hear people what they think about it. The group responsible for the DisplayPort protocol, you know, a lot of new, if you have a new laptop or new desk, I guess a lot of new desktops too, especially if you have Apple, they have DisplayPort for hooking up your video. And I know that it's on the PC world too. It's on, you know, on the Windows side too. They have announced that they have a new standard for the DisplayPort protocol, the 1.4A spec, which is designed to drive up to 8K displays. You know, we've talked about 4K video. They are actually jumping ahead and setting it up so that it can handle the data flows for 8K displays, which operate at 8.1 gigabits per second per lane. Let's see how many lanes.
Well, you know, there was the complicated thing about this was when the Retina iMac came out near the end of last year, there was a lot of talk about how the 5K display in the Retina iMac exceeds the DisplayPort, I think it was DisplayPort 1.2 spec. And everyone was kind of freaking out, like, how's Apple going to be able to deliver? They said it's going to be at this resolution, but that exceeds the DisplayPort spec. Well, Apple did it because with everything, with the display and everything being inside the box, they just custom engineered a video timing chip and worked sort of broke the spec, but did it in a way that is never going to matter because everything's inside the iMac box. But you can't use those, you know, with past Macs, there's always a way to kind of use it as in target display mode and be able to take advantage of the screen. You can't do it with the Retina iMac because there, at the time, until now, didn't exist a DisplayPort spec that was capable of addressing all the display's pixels. So this is a great way forward. It means that you'll see, instead of that, I think the highest resolution displays we'd see currently are that Ultra HD, which is like, it's almost 4K. It's like 3800 by something pixels. It's not quite like 4K. It's like almost 4K. But now that we've got the, and I mean, people don't always realize, you just, you know, you get so used to just plug in the cable and stuff magically works. These things are pushing just a ludicrous amount of raw data across the cable to refresh that many pixels. So yeah, this is a good thing. It's going to mean we'll get higher display monitors and stuff. A lot of which, I mean, the holdup on them hasn't necessarily been the panels. It's been the connectivity.
To be able to send data to
the bus.
The thing I wonder, though, are they actually then finally going to make the screens physically larger? You know, when you've got 8K worth of pixels, I don't understand when they cram 4K pixels into a 27-inch monitor.
I spent some time with the Retina iMac. It does make a difference.
Especially with text, and if you're doing a lot of development work with small fonts, it really, really helps.
It really did. I mean, it wasn't like, I don't necessarily think that the jump from 4K to 8K will be as big. You know, that math dictates that's going to be a smaller, even though it's a tremendous amount of pixels, it's going to be a smaller visual improvement. But yeah, I mean, this could conceivably pave the way towards gigantor computer displays. Or
Pete, the cat.
That's what I'm looking for.
Pete,
so it sounds like everybody is interested in trying that when it comes out. Of course, first step one is affording an 8K monitor when it comes out.
Yeah, that's going to take me a while. I'm still saving up for a $10,000 Ethernet cable. That looks really nice. Have you seen silver connectors?
I wrote the review of $10,000 Ethernet cable.
Forget that it's digital. That's the best part. This is an audiophile cable, and it's all zeros and ones.
I got into an extended Twitter argument with a guy who insisted that it makes a difference because even though the digital artifacts, or even though digital is digital, that the Ethernet cable still carries electromagnetic noise of some kind, and that noise will go through the cable, through the body of the computer and into the amp you're using to listen to your music.
It can, but you need to be isolating that. There are other ways to isolate. You don't do it with a $10,000 cable. You do it with a $300 piece of hardware you can get off of. Yeah.
You know that, but this guy really was insisting, because he had bought, this is an argument I was having with a guy on Twitter. You can go look me up and read it. He said he had the $50 version of that cable, and when he plugged that into his NAS and listened to the music on his NAS, that he noticed a huge difference in sound. And I was like, good for you. If you find joy in that purchase, then I'm happy.
You need
for
to stick
you.
An ice pick in your ear,
but you're not actually hearing sensitive. A real. And he was like, no, this, you obviously don't know what you're talking about because you've never taken a course in electromagnetic, whatever, and you don't know how electronics work.
This
There's
is
no
like that whole science where the science tells us it should be there based on everything else we know, although we can't actually detect the real thing that's supposed to be there.
It was like talking to a moon landing denier. I just was like, and eventually I just kind of gave up on the conversation because he got really rude and he was like, no, you need to understand that you're like wrong.
I just dropped a whole bunch of unnecessary money on a cable. He's got to defend his pocketbook and his psyche.
You're supposed to tell him how awesome he is.
It's like, dude, if you
sell him more cable. So you think that's good.
I was like, if your purchase makes you happy, then I'm happy for you. I think you're dumb, but you know what? It's good for you.
I have not successfully come to the station with enough juice in my laptop to run for the whole show. Do you?
Really? I have no problems.
That's because you charged before you got here. Well, you got nothing else to do but, you know, pop Vicodin and contemplate your shoulder.
My broken shoulder.
Do you have juice with you?
No, I don't. I brought this little slim thing.
I did the same thing, but it's not paying off for me today.
I usually bring the whole thing very
Flicted to the rescue.
Flicted will save me. He'll save me.
Hey, real quick, this is kind of interesting. So we were talking about the BitTorrent thing earlier.
Yeah.
After we talked about it, BitTorrent came out, and just like you've got, you know, like Netflix is doing their own, you know, originals, and I guess like Hulu's doing their own originals.
Yeah.
BitTorrent just inked a deal and announced it just a little bit ago that they are going to be offering legitimate content that they're going to be creating and partnering with some studios and distributing it just like Hulu or just like whatever. So it looks like they're going to start to maybe try to build their brand as
a
legitimate brand.
This is the honeypot again.
Yeah.
Where the FBI is going to put legitimate content out there to lure more people back to Pirate Bay, because there's some question as to whether or not, you know, Pirate Bay is a honeypot now. Which, if you don't know about Pirate Bay is a torrent aggregator. And
it's
you could
one
go,
of the very biggest ones.
And you could go, if you were looking for torrents of anything, you could find it at Pirate Bay, and they finally got shut down.
Not that I would know anything about that, but I heard that the Pirate Bay has been slightly vetted and is slightly clean, although a lot of the people that are uploading content and stuff to it, you shouldn't trust. I mean, I wouldn't go there and get stuff from it. They're, you know, go
I wouldn't go get it. You should never pirate stuff. Let's make that clear.
Ask Pete. He'll tell you.
I don't work at that place anymore, and I don't pirate software.
I mean, the nice thing is most things that you want to watch, you can find a legitimate place to go watch. And a lot of there are a lot of services that you can go watch it for free. You know, even like network TV these days, you can go and stream some stuff from the sites. You know, if you know where to go to find it for free, you can do it. And when I say for free, I mean legitimate, like go to CBS.com,
right.
Go to the actual
right
content creators, and they'll usually tell you how you can watch it.
Okay, here's an interesting try, buy, or fry. I'm interested to hear what you guys think on it. Scribd has added 10,000 digital comic books and graphic novels to its about $9 a month ebook and audiobook subscription service they announced yesterday. Participating comic publishers so far are Marvel, Archie, Boom Studios, Dynamite, IDW Top Shelf, and Valiant. DC Comics, which is the other big two comic publisher besides Marvel, is missing for now. Is that something? What do you guys think of that? Would you try that? Buy it or skip it?
Comic books.
Skip. don't care.
I know there are people out there listening, though, who this might be of value to, because at 10,000 digital comic books, that's a lot of quarters.
That's a lot of comic books.
Anyway, okay, and then the final one, this one is I stumbled across somebody talking about it for they use it with their MacBook Air to do and boot camp to have Windows on a MacBook Air with a 128 gig solid state drive, which is difficult. The big new thing, you know, you may have noticed there's like USB 3.0 flash drives out there, but some of them have gone farther than that, and this new one, the Corsair GTX, integrates a solid-state drive controller into basically a thumb drive.
Huh.
So you get so it's a 256 gigabyte USB flash drive with solid-state drive performance. It works with USB 2.0. and USB 3.0 ports on Windows, OS X, and Linux systems with no driver installation necessary. And, of course, it's around a couple hundred bucks, basically. And so it's got a zinc alloy body with aluminum accents and an integrated key ring.
Now, I mean, there's usually, you know, the difference between a solid-state disk, like you put in your computer, and a USB flash drive. Usually it's the same silicon, right? It's the same stuff in there. It's just on a solid-state disk, on a full solid-state disk, you'll have a really smart, really fancy controller, and everybody who makes those, Intel makes theirs, SandForce used to be big, they're kind of going down now, Samsung makes their own. These controllers will use all these kinds of different proprietary methods of usually simultaneously writing to eight or more of the NAND flash chips at once. And in a little thumb drive, there's usually not room to have as many chips. And so one of the reasons why your SSDs are so much faster is because you've got these brilliant controllers with incredibly complex, heavily optimized algorithms writing to lots of different chips simultaneously, lots of different NAND cells simultaneously. And it sounds like with this thing that there's a little bit of that going on, which should... You know, I've got a USB 3, I don't have it with me, I've got a USB 3 thumb drive that's pretty darn quick. It's not as fast as a, you know, MSAT, a solid state disk, but it's quick. And it sounds like this is a step beyond that even.
Yeah, I've seen on the article with the guy that was using it for boot camp, he tested it versus a hard drive, you know, regular spinning hard drive, you know, both USB 3.0 and all that, and he got much better performance, except he said, you know, basically if you were just going to use it to store photos, which I immediately then thought of Jay, you know, big files like that, and you're just moving those back and forth, you didn't get that much of a benefit, and you're better off, you know, getting the higher capacity of an external drive. But when you're doing things that require quick random access, that the thumb drive with that actually was much better than the spinning drive.
Yeah. All right. Well, that sounds like might be a buy.
Sounds like try or buy for a lot of people, huh?
Maybe. What did they? Did you say the price? How much are these things going to run?
It's around $200.
That's relatively pricey for a USB stick.
Although my main complaint about like pin drive Linux and, you know, being able to boot operating systems from the USB stick is that, you know, that initial load can be kind of slow, and then when it needs to go and get data, it usually has to read it off there and it has to decompress it. Like Lee said, you know, when you've got like maybe like you think of it like an 8-lane highway that you can normally get data off an SSD drive, a lot of these, you know, cheap USB sticks, it's like a 1-lane, I don't want to say dirt road, but it's definitely slower. So the idea of being able to have, you know, like a lot of bandwidth going between that USB stick and the computer for bootable distros off USB sticks, that's really cool. I think that'll change some things.
Yeah,
I think, Karen, basically, I think it's a nice compromise because a 256 gig, you know, if you had a full-on solid-state drive in an enclosure with a wire, you know, with the cable to hook it up, I'm sure you'd get a better result. It'd be faster and all of that. But you have to lug that around, where this is a way to have 256 gigs in your pocket with better than flash, you know, better than thumb drive performance.
Yeah.
For the $200, in the SSD world, that's pretty low end. That's towards the low end. So.
Well, I mean, yeah, the price for SSDs, it depends on who you're getting, what brand you're going with, and blah blah blah. But below 50 cents a gigabyte now, easily. Mm-hmm. So. That's definitely pricey, but at the same time, it's also you can stick it and plug it into a USB port, so that gains a lot there.
Yeah, so that one I thought that was the one of the three for tonight that was the most kind of like, ooh, you know, if it wasn't $200, I think it'd be a very much a. If it was $100, it'd be very much a like kind of splurge buy where you like go, yeah, no, I've just got to have this, because I've done that for you know, I remember when that was what you'd do to get a 16 gig thumb drive.
All right, I had an email come in from the website with a question, and since it's such an interesting question,
I like those.
I think that I want to present this to the Brain Trust. So he didn't put his name, or if he did, I can't pronounce it. But anyway, he emailed from the site. He says, "Gents, I'd like to be my visually impaired neighbor's sightseer if viable. What do we need to do to attach a wireless cam to his glasses? Google glasses are unaffordable, so I may guide him remotely from my PC and phone." So the first thing that came to my mind was to just maybe get an iPhone and wear it around your neck.
Yeah.
As a you know, just as a breast cam. Like,
well, let's be careful with that term.
Well, okay. you know, a jacket cam or chest cam or the problem that you're going to encounter, the first of all, is just getting that data from the camera to the internet to your phone so you can remote control this person. So that you have,
well, it sounds like if you get a phone, basically,
yeah,
right,
or FaceTime.
Well, yeah, but first of all, the technology, I don't see finding something cheap that you're going to be able to attach necessarily to their glasses that's going to have a data connection. Do they make webcams for iPhones? Can you get a phone and plug in an external camera to one of these? I've never even thought about it.
Well, I mean,
you could use the camera on the phone, but you can't attach that to your glasses to get the eye level thing.
I don't think so.
You could wear it like an Indian hat, I guess. Or
you
like
can
a,
with Android. So there's a cable
like,
for...
What's that Indian poker game?
Oh.
Right, where you hold the card up and everybody else can see it?
I don't think they call that anymore.
Like liar's poker or something?
Liar's poker. There it is. All right.
Yeah, so Android makes an OTG cable, which is an on-the-go cable. It's like a $7 cable that turns the USB port from a charging cable, and, you know, kind of this being a peripheral, into this being a USB host. And for Android, you can actually go and get a few. There's a handful of USB cameras that'll work. Plug it into your OTG cable, and you've got external webcam on Android.
How big is the camera?
the webcam?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, no, you would have to just go in whatever's out there. I've seen really small ones before.
Again, we're going back to the idea of where the guy wants to attach it to, at face level, so the guy can walk around.
I see this as like maybe like not a stethoscope, but what's the little reflective thing on the old 1950s doctors wore? Yes, like what you're doing. But I know that there are, like, for instance, headbands, you know, with those little bitty, you know, like, for instance, LED lights, headlamps.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I bet you could very easily, you know, take one of those on the cheap and then put one of these really cheap, you know, $20, $30 webcams that are very small up there and then just run the wire down and you're good to go.
Now, just buy a baseball cap and stick a cam on the bill.
I don't know about the software involved to do it, but I know that you can make a connection to a GoPro with an iPhone via Wi-Fi.
That's why, but you'd have to be local. I'm assuming that he's not going to be 100 yards away. He's going to be, you know, where they're going to need to leverage the LTE network or a cellular network.
Exactly. But I mean, if you could get it to the phone can get on the network. So can it be streamed? And then you have to get it streamed to a place where the other person can see the stream, whatever it is, whether it's on the cable or whatever. So the person doing the remote controlling of the blind guy has to be able to see the feed.
Yeah, so this is what you do.
I would be worried about the lag.
That's what I'm thinking. Like, oh yeah, the street's clear.
Google Hangout, and I probably would use it for that.
And if it's locked up or, you know, you can't hear, like when Pete was going on and on and probably saying, don't cross that street, we couldn't hear him. I think this sounds...
It's all clear as soon as this large Mack truck goes, but if it cuts out at the wrong point, it's going to end disastrously. But I would say just, you know, low ticket, go with off-the-shelf existing software, and that's, you know, if they want to get an Android camera or an Android phone and, you know, get a cheap
what
webcam.
I would do is, you know, if it was me, I would have them get a phone with a camera with an LTE connection. So they have internet in the camera and all of that. And then you can make a harness for the camera, either something you wear around your neck, a pouch or something, so the camera's facing out. It wouldn't be eye level, but it'd be, you know...
Chest level is good. The thing that wouldn't do is, you know, to see what's right or left. The person wouldn't be turning their head. They'd have to kind of rotate the body. But they could do that just as easily, you know.
It's still going to look go ahead, Pete.
If they did it, you know, think, you know, it came up a little bit earlier. But if you think about it, if they did a FaceTime call and he turned the camera basically wrong way, screen out, and had a Bluetooth headset or a Bluetooth earpiece, he can still talk and hear from the person on the other end. And the person can say, you know, turn to your left, turn to your right.
That's
kind of
a good idea. The Google
see.
Hangout or something like
that's
that.
That's what I'm trying to say.
And you don't
say,
have lag because it's like a call. It's not going to be like some of those with the Hangouts. Part of the problem, I think, might be that you're more likely to get lag than you are on something that's closer to a regular call.
Well, the nice thing, too, about the way that Hangout is integrated into Android is that it'll degrade the quality until it actually can make the connection. So it's not like, you know, if it doesn't have a lot of bandwidth available to it, especially, you know, just going phone to phone, that's the way it goes. You know, for instance, when you were calling Flick at the beginning of the show, it actually rang through to my phone. So, I mean, my phone acts as a Google Hangout device, and it's very easy. There's nothing to install. It's just, at least on Android, it's just there.
So then the blind guy can have five other people show up at his Hangout and help him. No, go over to the left. Get a hot dog.
Now, if he waited a little bit, I know that they're doing, like, actually implants. I know this, it's a long jump from a cockroach to a human. But I would say don't worry about barking orders. Get the implants, and you can actually control the person directly from the phone. Give it a couple years.
Or with a series of shocks to electric probes that you put on their head. Go left!
Could you get them to put, like, bio implants?
Or even just, you know, just little, and, you know, not to take it too far, but if he went to, like, TXRX Labs, or if they're in Houston, I'm sure there's some people down at the hackerspace that would like to build this. But, you know, just the same way you can do, because it's Google Yo-Yo, I-O-I-O, and it's a little bitty board that was, like, it's under $100. They're really cheap, not, like, $40. And it's an interface between your phone and physical computing, and it's got a cool API. So you could actually, if you're going to, you know, run a wire down, you could run a little vibrating thing down to your right hand and your left hand, and you could, you know, control that way. You know, my right wrist vibrates, I go right. Left wrist vibrates, I go left. You know, where you can kind of, you know, add remote control or augmented senses or do some cool stuff like that. Even to the point where you could, you know, he could put a infrared range sensor in front of him on the person himself, and he could vibrate if he gets too close to something. That's really cheap to do, but it does take some knowledge.
What would you do for sit down?
Both? That's easy. We get a third vibrator.
Whoa!
We're talking, like, not that kind. Afflicted. I think I got set up by Afflicted. He's just laughing away in there.
He didn't have to set you up, I don't think. I think
maybe
he
could get someone in the hackerspace to just build this guy a whole robot body.
Well, first of all, if Google Glass is too expensive, and I think you can get Google Glass on the secondary market for, I don't know that.
Oh, it's been kind of being retired though. Yeah. They're doing it corporately, but it's going away.
But you know, if I am going to put my blind friend on the street, I'm not going to go with second rate technology.
Well, it depends on how much of a friend he is.
Is this really the assumption that he wants to be able to autopilot him through busy traffic?
I don't know.
Because that's not
that.
A great idea.
He wasn't completely clear on that, but he said, I'd like to be my visually impaired neighbor's sightseer if available. Now, if it's just getting him around his house to tell him which shelf the
where's your mushroom soup or something like that.
That's a $5 bill.
Yeah.
And you owe me $5 and it's a whatever. But, you know, I would think for just the cheapest way to do it, and possibly it would be simple and reliable, would be to just get a data-connected phone with a camera and use that. And then, like Barrett mentioned, you could go the next step and have a Bluetooth, and you could actually make a phone call, get something with good battery life, and you could talk to them over the Bluetooth, either over the phone or through the Google Hangout using the microphone. So that's an interesting subject, and I wanted to go ahead and address that. I don't know if the person's listening.
Yeah, the nice thing about both phones, I know that Android does, and I'm pretty sure iPhone does it, is they've got a lot of accessibility built in, too. So, you know, you've got Siri, for instance, which will take voice commands. You can have things read back to you. So, you know, the idea of, you know, being visually impaired and not being able to operate a candy bar phone 10 years ago, that is kind of washed away with a lot of the abilities, you know, that the new smartphones have, you know, with reading things back out and, all the built-in
I know that
stuff.
I read this week that somebody is doing an app that's designed where blind people could, you know, where basically volunteers would be on the other end of it, where they would use that app and then, you know, point the camera at whatever it is that they wanted identified, and then the volunteers would respond and it would tell the person what it was they were looking at,
a Mechanical Turk, but for your eyes.
Yeah, and with I'm sure that their idea was to have the volunteers, you know, where you've screened them, so they're not just, you know, cruel jokers or whatever doing the thing. But
what is that? Not a cliff. Okay.
There's two knobs. They're just about chest level. Step forward two steps and give them a twist. You guys can all think about it and figure out what that is. We won't say on the air.
All right. Well, if you did want to call in, the phone number is 713-526-5738. We're only taking interesting questions and topics of discussion. If you have a spyware problem, that answer has already been published at geekradio.com under the spyware's link, so you're welcome to go there and learn all about that. If you have a really interesting problem that you can't find an answer to through Googles and stuff, we'll entertain those as well.
Like if your computer is literally alive,
if your computer has achieved sentience,
we will talk about that.
All right.
Hey, Flicted, have you seen the Chappie movie preview?
He has.
Yes.
I saw the first. Yes.
Did I see who I think I saw in there? Is that
the
Antwoord?
Yep.
Are they both in there?
Yeah.
Yes,
that's awesome.
They are.
So is that going to be a good movie, I hope?
I just saw the thing. It's going to have an R rating.
Well, yeah, it's the guy that did District 9.
Oh, okay. That makes a little bit of sense then. Yeah. So that same kind of feel, same kind of.
Although it's interesting, you know, I read some articles.
It's just a remake of Circuit. Short Circuit.
Short
I thought
circuit.
It was a remake
oh,
of
Johnny
a,
Five.
The Snowman story where the Short hat circuit. Goes on the snowman and the snowman
Happy
comes
birthday.
Alive. Aren't they all sort of remakes
Happy
of that?
Birthday!
Number five is alive. Five. I think actually Chappie actually said something about Chappie is alive. Or it just sounded a lot like Short Circuit.
So I saw a preview and I was looking in the back and there's a band out of, I guess, they're Afrikaans, right? So I guess South Africa.
It's
Ninja and then help
Yolandi.
Me out with her name. Yolandi.
Visser.
Yeah.
Yolandi.
So they're both, I saw them both in it. I'm just wondering if that was just a cameo or if
no,
they're going to be
in it.
No,
they're in it.
That's awesome.
Significant role.
Okay, that's
they're
really cool.
I'm actually looking forward to that. That looks like, I don't do too many movies anymore, but that one is one I think I'll
is that a summer movie? I guess I've got Google here. I could
go. There's 10,000 laptops in this room.
Maybe if I put a phone on and then y'all could see what I'm seeing and then give me information that's pertinent to my life.
No.
That would be awesome.
I don't think so.
What about, hey, Lee, let me ask you this. What about, like, Oculus Rift and things like that? Is that quite there yet for an application?
Because
I guess the guy doesn't really need to be visually. He doesn't need to be VR-worthy, visually impaired guy is.
I don't know. Maybe. That would be interesting. I mean, it's the complicated thing is, well, you know, I don't know. You'd have to have two cameras on the fellow out in the street because, I guess you could have one, but you'd be better off if you only have one camera with sending it to a TV.
Is there a way that you can pair with like a phone's Wi-Fi to get the data back, I guess? Is there any built-in stuff or is that really hard to do?
There is an SDK that you could go bang something out.
So they would have to program, so probably not then. Okay.
No. There's no application out of the box that'll do that. Not at all. Now, there is an application out of the box that'll let you hook up the current Oculus Rift dev kit with the Leap Motion infrared camera tracker thing. So you can, the way that they're using it is, Leap Motion is a gesture-based infrared controller. So you stick it on the desk in front of you, and you can kind of wave your hand at it, and you pick up how many fingers and the motion. It actually works really well. I've got one. And if you keep your expectations set relatively low, it can do some neat stuff. You're not going to use it with your hands out in front of you like Minority Report or anything, but it's neat. So they've hooked up, there's a deal with, you can actually put Velcro the Leap Motion controller to the front of your Rift, and then you can actually have your, while you're with the Rift on, in a demo that supports it, have your hands in front of you and move them around as if, because that's the thing that everybody does. As soon as you put the Rift on in a game, you immediately are like, oh, I want to move my hands around because I can see this 3D world in front of me. And of course, there's, you know, your hands aren't connected to anything. So you're waving your hands around like a crazy person in real life, and you see nothing in front of you, and it totally screws your proprioception up, and you have no idea what's going on. So this is a way to do that.
Here we go. So in new breaking news, and this isn't this new, this is like March of 2014, but it looks like Samsung is working on some assistive technology stuff for Samsung's Galaxy Core Advanced smartphone, which I believe is an Android phone. And it's going to have, there's going to be a cover that you can snap the phones into, and it's going to have, one of the covers is an ultrasonic cover, which will detect objects up to 6 feet away from the user. And I bet they're using, like the ping sensors, they're using, you know, IR detection. So instead of, you know, going to have to, you know, cobble one together in your maker workshop, you can actually, it looks like, go to Samsung and
Where's
get
the
that.
Phone in that?
I bet, I mean, and that's the whole thing. I bet there's no one really wants to, while, you know, being able to telepresence, you know, a visually impaired person is great. I bet no developer wants to be the first person to have someone wander out in the street because of lag. I mean, I'm not going to touch that.
There's somewhat of a liability.
So I bet there's some safety issues with that. There are a lot of, you know, applications out there and a lot of apps that, you know, are targeted towards people with poor vision, but no turn left, go straight, you know, none of that
right.
yet.
No mechanical Turk for blind people directions.
But this is neat. I would Google Samsung Galaxy Core Advance or ultrasonic cover, and you'll see what Samsung's doing. That's kind of neat.
Although you wonder a bit about, aren't there walking directions? I know there's walking directions on Google Maps often, and I think there's also on it may be on Apple's Maps and some of the other map ones. It seems like that might actually be useful for, you know, it's not going to tell you that, you know, whether the light's green, but it would tell you that, you know, go up three blocks and then you're going to turn left kind of thing, and do the kind of GPS direction thing where it's like, you know, now it's one block, now it's two, now it's a half block, you know, now you should be turning left, and then they might have to, you know, that, then they would need help on the, you know, okay, is it available for me to cross? But they wouldn't be able to navigate to places they've not been before without, you know, it would give the basic information.
Yes.
What he said.
Yes.
GPS for blind people. It's kind of an odd concept, but it could work.
BPS. It's the blind person positioning system.
as we talk about all the equipment to go on this hypothetical blind person, people of a certain age might be like me and think of Al Franken doing his presidential coverage back in the day where he had a satellite dish on his head.
Yes, yes. Oh, a backpack. Serious politician Al Franken is. I remember that. That was common, old school Comedy Central stuff.
Google that. I'm sure it's on YouTube.
I'm sure it is. And now he's a senator for real, doing senator stuff.
All right.
True dat.
What's next?
He really is.
What are we
I got a couple science things if we want to do that.
Okay.
Can we get our science on?
Yeah, we can get our weird science on. I still don't have the bumper ready for it, but we'll get there.
Just sing the song yourself.
You can science.
You know, well, you know how when you work, you know, often people, you know, at work they bring home office supplies or, you know, the occasional pen or 3x5 card or whatever. Well, imagine if you were like one of the first people to go to the moon. They found, you know, and when they left, as you may, if you've been following along, see now we're sort of doing the sequential thing. If you've been following along on the Weird Science, we talked about all the stuff that's been left on the moon, you know, the lander and all that. Oops. Well, apparently, realizing that this stuff would be left, Neil Armstrong took a couple different things that were, they actually were nailed down, and he took them, and these were found in a bag in his closet by his wife, the late Neil Armstrong.
And it's not anything like major. He didn't like take the plutonium out of the thing and, you know, hide it. He didn't take the keys from the lunar module or anything, but it's just kind of a neat little assortment of stuff.
Yeah. The biggest thing is probably the 16 millimeter data acquisition camera used to record the iconic moment that he reached the lunar surface. You know, basically, I mean, the jokes about stealing office supplies aside, the stuff he has is historically relevant, and nobody's thought is, oh my gosh, you know, Neil Armstrong was a thief. So don't misunderstand us joking about it. You know, the things he's got are apparently on display at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum.
Well, and there was a law passed a few years ago, I believe relatively recently, that essentially says that astronauts who come into contact with this equipment and take personal mementos, like those mementos are the astronaut's property, and the U.S. government doesn't have the right to seize them, because that's come up in the past, and it's been a big deal of, you know, like I took this, you know, I'm an astronaut, and I took this handle off of this one thing, piece of equipment that was going to be destroyed, but, and then the government says, well, that's our property, you have to give that back, and so that's no longer the case. So, but yeah, I saw the same thing that you did on these. You can, these artifacts are now in the possession of the Smithsonian. They were donated, and you can actually go and see them.
And then our next science story that's kind of cool, there's the NASA's Dawn spacecraft has been heading out to the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, and it took the sharpest images yet of its target, the dwarf planet Ceres. And if you go to geekradio.com, you can see the dwarf planet. They combined the images and made an animated GIF, so you can see this dwarf planet rotating in the GIF, and it's pretty cool. Essentially, the deal is it's less than 150 million miles to go. They released some new images, and so now the Dawn probe has a sharper view of this dwarf planet than the Hubble Space Telescope can get. So, kind of cool. It's a big rock in space, but the clearer you can see it, I mean, it's one of these things, you know, the moon, you think about it, with a really strong telescope, you can see pretty big detail. This is something that is so far away that even the Hubble can't get as good a view as what you can see in that animated GIF. And then finally, there's some SpaceX news. They had a few different things. The SpaceX has reached an agreement to use a former Atlas launch pad at Cape Canaveral's Air Force Station, as a landing site for returning Falcon rocket boosters. The 45th Space Wing confirmed Tuesday, and no, that's not, even though it sounds like a bad, like, superhero team from cartoons, it actually is a part of the Air Force with a general who's in charge of it.
Yeah,
the deal, you know, you keep hearing about SpaceX trying to land on a barge out at sea. What it is they're trying to land the booster on the barge to prove that they can do it safely out there in the ocean where it doesn't matter, so that then once they can prove that they can do it, then they'd be allowed to try it at the on-land landing site. So that's how this ties in with the other stuff, where they've been doing tests and they actually canceled the, twice they've canceled the tests. But they're coming up on having to do it again. They as one of the tests, they're going to launch the Discover satellite, which they canceled it yesterday with only 12 minutes remaining in the countdown because they were getting 115 mile an hour wind gusts. So that's sounds like the discretion being the better part of valor. But so they're going to launch it, and then Discover will go into deep space, and then when it comes back, the thruster will booster is they're going to try to land it on the barge. So that's all the space news and space and science news I've got tonight.
Spectacular.
All right. Well, I talking about interesting technologies available. I know that there's been a lot of conversation around cord cutting, and I have moved more towards cord embracing in my latest technology upgrade. Xfinity has this platform called the X1 platform, which is their new entertainment system that they're promoting pretty heavily. And if you have the new X1 system, it's really cool because, like, right now I have one DVR, but I can watch any of my recorded programs on any of the other televisions in the house that have
DLNA or whatever it is.
It's not DLNA so much. It's somehow their devices talk to each other. Maybe it's DLNA, but I can get to all my saved programs from any other TV in the house without having to have an additional DVR, which is an additional fee, which is expensive through them, like everything else is. but what they've been advertising, and this is one of the breakdowns, I think, where Comcast and Xfinity fail in a big way, is that they advertise what they have. And if you're a new customer and you sign up, you'll get the stuff that they're advertising. But if you're an existing customer, you don't get the good deals. So when I got X1 in the first place, it was only because I was seeing them advertising. I said, okay, what do I need to do to convert my stuff to X1? Because I want all of those features, because the menus and the recordings and four channels at once and, you know, record four things at once, watch a fifth show and all that. I wanted that. So I had to have them come out and do, I took the opportunity to retool my subscription and went for their triple play, which was less than what I was paying for their double play anyway. And so I actually got my bill down and I got the system, and then they started advertising. Now they have this service where your DVR, the stuff that you record, you can watch it on your mobile device logged into your account over the internet. Yeah. So if I DVR stuff, I can watch it. And beyond that, they even have it where if you're at your home Wi-Fi, you can watch live television on your device.
Can we watch your recorded episodes of Real Housewives right now?
It's recording. I haven't finished.
Okay.
but what's even more interesting is that you can download from your DVR to your device so that you can take it with you, like on a plane and stuff.
So that's the question. So does it have to check into the service to do authentication, or if you're completely cut off and you're in airplane mode, can you still watch those videos?
Once you've downloaded it, you'd have to download it over your Wi-Fi.
And into their app in an encapsulated way that you can't take the file out later?
It has a 30-day timeout. Okay. It will re-upload or, you know, I think when you download it, it's no longer available on your DVR. It's only available on the device.
Oh, so you're kind of checking it out?
Okay. You're checking it out from your own library.
Okay, so it's kind of like lending, like when Amazon had that lending book method where you could lend a friend a book and it's out of yours, they've got it, so you're lending it to a different device.
Right.
Okay.
So you can download it to your device. So like if you DVR a movie, so you could go into your DVR, set it up to record whatever that you can record, whatever you're subscribed to. You can record movies, do that. Then you could download it to your device and take it with you.
So it's more convenient than before, but it still totally misses the point of the actual potential of having digital copies and screws the customer over ultimately in a way that subverts like all of the things that are unique about the digital medium.
It's more of a reach around than it's been in the past.
Yes, absolutely.
How about that?
It's more convenient than it was in that now you have some option.
Well, it used to be that if you would DVR something, you'd record it, you'd have to be in your house to watch it.
Right.
You couldn't get it to your computer. You couldn't. Now, I'm sure that once you can get it to your device, there are hacks or ways to be able to get that digital content and do whatever you want.
But it might not do you any good if it's all you get out of it is an encrypted file.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't gone that far yet. But
the sad part is how reactive that is with Comcast, because a lot of these things are things that the satellite providers, because they have to compete more, they don't have as big a base as, say, Comcast does. They've had a lot of those kinds of features for quite a while. The check it out and the check it out from your DVR and watch it remotely is the only one that sounds new to me. From like DirecTV basically has a lot of stuff where you can watch, where you can watch things that are on your DVR or where you can watch live television on your your device.
It's not as neat as it could be if they would relax the ludicrous restrictions that are in place around digital content that exist only to appease content providers and screw consumers over. It's not as neat as it could be.
Now, if you own your own media and you're doing stuff, there's Plex is pretty cool too, because Plex is free and it lets you do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like on my smartphone, I can see what I've got on my home server.
Yes, but without any of the idiotic DRM.
But you have to get the content in the first place.
Yeah, you need the content.
You need the content in the first place.
So yeah, and I would love to pay for a... I'd love to pay for a field trip for the Comcast executives and the other content executives to go to the recording industry's headquarters and talk to them about how if you really nail down the content, how that's going to make you even more successful, because I think they'd get an earful.
Well, yeah, but they don't. I don't think that's a lesson that you can be taught externally. It's a lesson.
I would think after watching the recording industry take the 2x4 to the head that they took over the move from CDs to MP3s.
They've seen it.
I would think you couldn't miss that.
The content industry is convinced that additional controls and tighter controls are the way to go, and eventually us consumers will fall in line. That's simply the way it is. And I agree that history has shown that that's not how it's going to work if you look at the music industry. But the content industry as a whole doesn't seem to have learned that lesson, and it's we'll see how it goes.
I think the reason why cord adding, as Jay mentioned at the beginning of this segment, is it's unusual to hear somebody mention it, is because the current flow is in the opposite direction.
Very much so.
Well, I think what it boils down to there, and I mean, there's been a lot of discussion with cord cutting about all these different ways to deliver content, and there's not a one-stop place to do it. I mean, you've got your Amazons, your Hulus, and now you've got the Sling TV that's come around. So you can get a box like a Roku box and kind of have these different subscriptions and stuff that you can manage, but you don't have any... If it's streaming in like live television, you don't have the ability to record that or do your own playback. I still think there needs to be a device that aggregates all the content from different providers so that...
Yeah, it seems like some of the, the TiVo type boxes, that the problem is they're limited from doing that last step, because I know they do have boxes that are the Sling box, which is not related to Sling TV,
right?
Does some of those things, but obviously is prevented from doing all of them.
Whoever does it and builds it will get sued out of existence.
And rich.
Yes, that one they can go to Aereo and find out about, right?
No kidding.
All right, well, there's the theme music.
I hear it. I hear the music.
You know, I have the... The one thing I have to consider when I'm considering all these different technologies is how easy is it for my wife to use?
Yes.
She's like the antithesis of my nerdiness. So, and to the point where I even had to downgrade her from a Mac to a Windows PC just so she could get some work done. And so when you talk about all these different cord cutting options, my wife is lucky if she, and I think this is the average person. I'm not saying anything bad about my wife or women or anything like that, but the average person trying to get their content on the TV is tough. All right, we are out of time.
Out of time.
So we will be back next Wednesday for more Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
For
For the month of February, 90.1 KPFT has been selected as one of the local nonprofits competing for your vote at Okra Charity Saloon in downtown Houston. The concept is simple. For each drink purchased, guests receive one vote that they may cast that night for their favorite organization. The charity with the most votes at the end of the month receives the next month's proceeds. Okra is located at 924 Congress, near the corner of Main Street and Congress. Again, throughout the month of February, KPFT is one of the candidates for support. You can chip in to vote with the purchase when you patronize Okra. You can visit Okra on Congress anytime in February to cast a vote for KPFT. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
First you listen, then you fall in love, you have your favorite programs that you listen to each and every week, and finally you do the right thing by calling in that pledge of support to KPFT. You feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today, and when you do, you take that often forgotten last step. Don't wait any longer. KPFT depends on you. First you listen, then you fall in love, you have your favorite programs that you listen to each and every week, and finally you do the right thing by calling in that pledge of support to KPFT. You feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today,